Welcome to another installment of Gita Wisdom. These weekly classes are, or discussions, I hope, are intended to stretch our heads. When my teacher Prabhupada came to America, which was in September of 1965, he took a very big risk. He risked presenting something that externally appeared like Hinduism. And the challenge that he took on, which was a challenge issued by his teacher, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, back in 1922, when they first met, Prabhupada was 26 at the time, was to bring these ancient teachings of devotion to Krishna to the West and to speak in English language. And for many years, Prabhupada, who at the time was known as Abhay Charanaravinda, Abhay Babu, his friends would call him Abhay Babu, he's tried in many, many different ways. He was first married and a pharmacist. He ran a pharmaceutical company. But his heart wasn't in it. You know, he was someone who was called to the ministry, if you will, who really saw his whole life as caring for people's spiritual progress. And he wanted to fulfill that instruction. There had been prophecies about this, going back hundreds and hundreds of years, that the day will come when Westerners will take up the chanting of Hare Krishna and the devotional bhakti yoga practice. I mean, ancient, some of the prophecies were thousands of years old. And nothing had happened for so long. And then Prabhupada came, and some of those forecasts are quite specific about there would be a great temple in Mayapur, which was the appearance place of Chaitanya, who brought the chanting into the public in the 1500s in Bengal, and how that would be spreading around the world, and so on and so forth. Well, when he came, he had this daunting task of trying to convey the relevance of these ancient teachings to a spiritually bankrupt culture. And my conviction is that those of us who had the privilege of knowing him inherited the responsibility of uncovering the language with which to convey these ancient teachings in a way that we can understand today. What, you know, the world constantly evolves. Things are always changing around us. What does ahimsa mean today, perhaps differently than it did 500 or 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 years ago? Has that notion evolved and changed somehow? And if so, how? The idea of dharma, or the responsibility of life. There was a time when if you wanted to be a spiritual person, you didn't stay in the city. You got out. Hey! You know, if you wanted to be spiritual, if you wanted to do yoga, you did not stay in a crowded community. You split. You went out to the forest, to the mountains, to the caves. And you know, gurus were not online then. You know, you had to climb for days, you know, through treacherous passages to get to someone who may, you know, deign to receive you for a few minutes, you know, and give you instruction. The dynamic has changed in so many ways. So one of the things that I love doing is finding points of communication between these ancient teachings and the world around us. Some years ago, I happened upon a description of fractals. And I looked at it and said, gee, you know, this... It rang a bell of some kind for me, but I couldn't quite figure it out right away. And the bell, over time, I realized that what this bell was that God is the ultimate artist. And it brought to memory a conversation that I'd had with Prabhupada in Paris. It must have been 1973. And I was alone with him, and he was in... At the time, we had this little house in the suburbs of Paris. Very, very French little neighborhood, you know. Everybody, in the morning, they go to the market, and they have their baguette, you know, and their fromage. And here, you know, we were this kind of little band of brothers and sisters. And Prabhupada visited. He came from Moscow, which is... He made a trip to Moscow just previously. So was that 73? Maybe 72. And I was, you know, just like busting with questions. Whenever I saw him, I was totally irreverent, you know, ridiculously so. I would ask him about anything, you know. I asked him one time, what should we tell people when they ask us how come our sannyasis are falling down and getting married? You know, there are the devotees in the room at the time. They fell off their cushions. They're like, Yogeshwar, what are you doing? And Prabhupada took it very seriously. You know, he was always very courteous and understanding in that way. And he thought for it, said, no, it's a good question. And he said, we have some precedent in our lineage. He said, Nityananda Mahaprabhu was a sannyasi, and then afterwards he was married. He said, so we have some precedent. But what does it matter? That was the bottom line for him. What does it matter? If someone is in the renounced order or married or single, or what does it matter? As long as they're doing a service that makes them happy and they're going on with their... I thought, what a wonderful equipoised perspective that was. You know, okay, someone tried being, you know, a renunciant and it didn't work. All right, what are you going to do? Kick them away? You know, just be compassionate, be understanding, and love them, you know. Help them find a place that they're, you know. At a time like that, the thing that someone needs most is understanding and compassion and friendship. You know, that if someone's having a hard time with their spiritual life, you don't condemn them, you know. You try to understand and be of a support in some way.
So he actually said that he said what does it matter as long as they're doing something that makes them happy?
If they're doing their service, if they're going on with their services, what does it matter? This ashram, that ashram, what does it matter? I mean, he wasn't fanatical. We were fanatical, but he was never fanatical. He was very rational. So, one time I asked him, what is art? What is art? And his answer was totally baffling. He said, oh, art is not what people think it is. He says, art is putting something in its proper place for best utility. I said, what does that mean? Putting something in its proper place for best utility. And I said, can you help me to understand that a little more? He said, yes. An artist is someone who knows the utility of something, who knows what is its proper engagement, and puts it in that place for proper use. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, I don't know how that defines art, but now remember, this was like the early 70s. Andy Warhol was very big still, right? And I think, well, some people, some artists like Andy Warhol take something out of its proper place. You know, they'll take a soup can off the shelf and put it on a pedestal and call it art, you know. And I said, you know, you have other people who do splatter paintings, you know, which don't strike me as putting things in proper place. And he looked at me with this kind of snide little smile and took an imaginary brush in his hand and waved it back and forth in the air like this. And he said, well, maybe that's art for you. Maybe you like that. You know? kind of imitating, what was his name out there in the Hamptons?
Jackson Pollock.
Yeah, it was like an imitation Jackson. He said, maybe you like that. He said, and then we had a, you know, went on, the conversation went on for quite a while, until finally it kind of came clear to me that what he was talking about was that there's a difference between art and beauty. Beauty is relative. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Beauty, what's beautiful for you may not be beautiful for me. We have different tastes. But art, in the Vedic sense of the word art, means that which reveals the soul and the soul's relationship to God. Art has a spiritual purpose behind it. And I said, okay, all right, if that's the definition that we're discussing here, then it means that anybody doing anything as an act of devotion would be an artist. He said, yes, you've understood. Someone sweeping the street with that sense of, I'm doing this as an act of devotion to my beloved Krishna, person's an artist. So you can bring to whatever you do artistry. And in the spiritual sense, it can be inspired, uplifting art if the motive that you bring to it is one of devotion. So that's the kind of conversation that I would have with him. And frankly, that's why I stayed a devotee. Because, that was beautiful. And ever since then, I've marveled at how the more we discover about the nature of creation, the more it's clear that there's an artistic hand at work there. And sometimes we don't see it because our senses are very blunt. We don't always see the artistry behind something, especially if it's painful or chaotic, right? The Gita, the Bhagavad Gita, doesn't use the word chaos. We might learn to replace that word with unpredictable, because we don't have intelligence that's sufficiently large enough to see the order within the chaos, but it's there. Here's a simple example. If you boil a pot of water, the bubbles just seem to be going every which way. Doesn't seem to be any particular order to it. It's very chaotic, right? Well, if you slowed it down and went up closer, what you'd see is that as the molecules heat, they rise and they're bouncing off one another in a very, very precise way. There's order there. But we can't see it. Our senses are too blunt. Or take a jar of marbles and layered colored marbles in that jar, and if you shake it up, and you look at it, it looks chaotic. It doesn't look like any particular sense to it. Again, slow it down and go inside, and what you see is that things are acting in a predictable way, but we can't see it. Now apply that same principle to the chaos within our lives. The event chaos, the relationship chaos, the economic chaos. Right? It may seem unfair, and it can lead to a sense of despair, to a sense of purposelessness. This world makes no sense. My life makes no sense. And in the extreme, it can lead to depression and even suicide. Because what do you do when the world is chaotic? It means that you can't count on any formulas or any predictable pattern of behavior to bring you out of that chaos. We'd like to think that we live in a world where doing good is rewarded. We'd like to think that we live in a world where if you follow the rules, if you keep your nose clean, if you lead a good life, that somehow there's some mechanism of reward at work in the world, and you'll reap the benefits of that. And well, now we know that the world doesn't work like that. Doesn't seem to, at least. You know, good people suffering terrible circumstances, totally evil people seemingly getting away with it. You know, where is the sense? Where's the order in all of that? So the study of Bhagavad Gita is the refining of our tools of perception so that we're capable of not reacting to the chaotic circumstances of life in a knee-jerk emotional way only. Might be hard to avoid emotional reaction, but balancing that reaction with a deeper perception of the structures and the meanings and the purpose going on beyond what senses can perceive. Okay. All right, so what I'd like to do is play for you a little bit of this Nova special. I'm big on Nova specials, if you haven't figured that out already. That describes the work of Benoit Mandelbrot. Now, just a little bit about Mandelbrot. Mandelbrot survived World War II. He was prosecuted by the Nazis and started his work at IBM. Managed to make his way over to the States. He was a mathematician who was able to perceive certain repeating patterns. Something that he saw in the way things repeated suggested to him that nature's got some kind of a plan at work here. There's something going on. And thanks to the evolution in computer technology, if you're working at IBM, you get access to all this cool equipment. He was able to make certain calculations that showed him what some of those repeating patterns in nature are. And I'm not going to play the whole thing for you, obviously. But what we'll see is that we admire symmetry because we see it. What Mandelbrot was able to do was track where does it come from. So let me play a little bit of this for you. And then we'll chat some more about it. Okay? Yeah.
Would you mind just placing the stand
yes.
a little over to the right?
Yes, will do. We're coming in on this documentary about halfway through or so. And what's happened so far is that the first part has been kind of some background on Mandelbrot, who passed away some years ago, maybe 10 years ago now. So there's some of the history of fractals, what do you call it, or sometimes the M sets, as they're called. And now we're at a point where we're seeing, well, what is all of this repeating pattern good for? People always ask that, you know. What is the knowledge of subatomic particles, you know, what's the bottom line? What's it good for? Well, if you would ask that question maybe 20 years ago, people in physics would have said, well, nothing in particular. But today, about 75% of the technology in this cell phone, this smartphone, is predicated on the behavior of subatomic particles. So the practical applications may come out later on. You're going to see a little bit of the practical applications here of this discovery by Mandelbrot of nature's use of repeating patterns. So let's just play this for a while and then we'll talk some more. It starts off with this clip of special effects from Star Wars.
The same kinds of fractal design principles have completely transformed the magic of special effects.
This is a key moment from Star Wars Episode 3. Where our two heroes have run out onto the end of this giant mechanical arm, and the lava splashes down onto the arm, My starting point here is to actually take the three-dimensional model and take essentially a jet and just shoot lava up into the air. This looks kind of boring. It's doing roughly the right thing, but the motion has no kind of visual interest to it. Let's look at what happens here when I add the fractal swirl to it. Where this becomes fractal is we take that same swirl pattern, we shrink it down and reapply it. We take that, we shrink it down again, we reapply it. We shrink it down again, we reapply it. And from here on, it's just a case of layering up more and more and more. I've used the same technique to create these additional lava streams. I then do it again here to get some just red-hot embers. Then we take all of those layers and we add them up, and we get the final composite image. My hero lava in the foreground, the extra lava in the background, the embers, sparks, steam, smoke.
Designers and artists the world over have embraced the visual potential of fractals. But when the Mandelbrot set was first published, mathematicians, for the most part, reacted with scorn.
In the Mathematical Intelligencer, which is a gossip sheet for professional mathematicians, there were article after article saying he wasn't a mathematician, he was a bad mathematician, it's not mathematics, fractal geometry is worthless.
The I had been banished out of science. The I had been excommunicated.
His colleagues, especially the really good ones, pure mathematicians that he respected, they turned against him.
Because, you know, you get used to the world that you've created and that you live in, and mathematicians had become very used to this world of smooth curves that they could do things with.
They were clinging to the old paradigm. When Mandelbrot and a few people were way out there bringing in the new paradigm. And he used to call me up on the telephone late at night because he was bothered and we'd talk about it. Mandelbrot was saying, this is a branch of geometry just like Euclid. It offended them. They said, no, this is an artifact of your stupid computing machine.
I know very well that there is this line that fractals are pretty pictures, but they're pretty useless. Well, it's a pretty jingle, but it's completely ridiculous.
Mandelbrot replied to his critics with his new book, The Fractal Geometry of Nature. It was filled with examples of how his ideas could be useful to science. Mandelbrot argued that with fractals, he could precisely measure natural shapes and make calculations that could be applied to all kinds of formations, from the drainage patterns of rivers to the movements of clouds.
So this domain of growing living systems, which I, along with most other mathematicians, had always regarded as pretty well off limits for mathematics and certainly off limits for geometry, suddenly was center stage. It was Mandelbrot's book that convinced us that this wasn't just artwork. This was new science in the making. This was a completely new way of looking at the world in which we live that allowed us not just to look at it, not just to measure it, but to do mathematics and thereby understand it in a deeper way than we had before.
As someone who's been working with fractals for 20 years, I'm not going to tell you fractals are cool. I'm going to tell you fractals are useful. And that's what's important to me.
In the 1990s, a Boston radio astronomer named Nathan Cohen used fractal mathematics to make a technological breakthrough in electronic communication. Cohen had a hobby. He was a ham radio operator, but his landlord had a rule against rigging antennas on the building.
I was at an astronomy conference in Hungary, and Dr. Mandelbrot was giving a talk about the large-scale structure of the universe and reporting how using fractals as a very good way of understanding that kind of structure, which really wowed the entire group of astronomers. He showed several different fractals that I, in my own mind, looked at and said, oh, wouldn't it be funny if you made an antenna out of that shape? I wonder what it would do.
One of the first designs he tried was inspired by one of the 19th century monsters, the snowflake of Helge von Koch.
I thought back to the lecture and said, well, I've got a piece of wire. What happens if I bend it? After I bent the wire, I hooked it up to the cable and my ham radio, and I was quite surprised to see that it worked the first time out of the box. It worked very well. And I discovered that, much of a surprise to me, that I could actually make the antenna much smaller using the fractal design. So it was, frankly, an interesting way to beat a bad rap with a landlord.
Cohen's experiments soon led him to another discovery. Using a fractal design not only made antennas smaller, but enabled them to receive a much wider range of frequencies.
Using fractals, experimentally, I came up with a very wideband antenna. And then I worked backwards and said, why is it working this way? What is it about nature that requires you to use the fractal to get there? The result of that work was a mathematical theorem that showed if you want to get something that works as an antenna over a very wide range of frequencies, you need to have self-similarity. It has to be fractal in its shape to make it work. Now, that was an exact solution. It wasn't like, oh, here's a way of doing it, and there's a lot of other ways of doing it. It turned out mathematically, we were able to demonstrate that was the only technique you used to get there.
Cohen made his discovery at a time when cell phone companies were facing a problem. They were offering new features to their customers, like Bluetooth, walkie-talkie, and Wi-Fi. But each of them ran on a separate frequency.
You need to be able to use all those different frequencies and have access to them without 10 stubby antennas sticking out at the same time. The alternative option is you can let your cell phone look like a porcupine, but most people don't want to carry around a porcupine.
Today, fractal antennas are used in tens of millions of cell phones and other wireless communication devices all over the world.
We're going to see over the next 10 to 15 to 20 years that you're going to have to use fractals because it's the only way to get cheaper cost and smaller size for all the complex telecommunication needs we're having.
Once you realize that a shrewd engineer would use fractals in many, many contexts, you better understand why nature, which is shrewder, uses them in its ways.
They're all over in biology. They're solutions that natural selection has come up with over and over and over and over again.
One powerful example, the rhythms of the heart. Something that Boston cardiologist Ari Goldberger has been studying his entire professional life.
I mean, the neat thing about the notion of sort of the human body as a machine goes back through the tradition of Newton and the machine-like universe. So somehow we're machines, we're mechanisms. The heartbeat is this timekeeper. Galileo was reported to have used his pulse to time the swinging of a pendular motion. So that all fit in with the idea that the normal heartbeat is like a metronome.
But when Goldberger and his colleagues analyzed data from thousands of people, they found the old theory was wrong.
This is where I showed the heartbeat time series of a healthy subject. And as you can see, the heartbeat is not constant over time. It fluctuates, and it fluctuates a lot. For example, in this case, it fluctuates between 60 beats per minute and 120 beats per minute.
The patterns looked familiar to Goldberger, who happened to have read Benoit Mandelbrot's book.
When you actually plotted out the intervals between heartbeats, what you saw was very close to the rough edges of the mountain ranges that were in Mandelbrot's book. You blow them up, expand them, you actually see that there are more of these wrinkles upon wrinkles. The healthy heartbeat, it turned out, had this fractal architecture. People said, this isn't cardiology, we do cardiology if you want to get funded. But it turns out it is cardiology.
Goldberger found that the healthy heartbeat has a distinctive fractal pattern, a signature that one day may help cardiologists spot heart problems sooner.
Please look around the screen for me. All right, Cooper, we're going to do the calibration.
At the University of Oregon, Richard Taylor is using fractals to reveal the secrets of another part of the body, the eye.
What we want to do is see what is that eye doing that allows it to absorb so much visual information. And so that's what led us into the eye trajectories. Under the monitor is a little infrared camera which will actually monitor where the eye is looking, and it actually records that data. And so what we get out is a trajectory of where the eye has been looking.
Oh, it's interesting how they go around the pattern.
And so the computer will get out this graph, and it will look, you know, have all of these various little structure in it. And it's that pattern that we zoom in, we tell the computer to zoom in on and see the fractal dimension.
The tests show that the eye does not always look at things in an orderly or smooth way. If we could understand more about how the eye takes in information, we could do a better job of designing the things that we really need to see.
A traffic light. You're looking at the traffic light. You've got traffic, you've got pedestrians. Your eye is looking all over the place trying to assess all of this information. People design aircraft cockpits, rows of dials and things like that. If your eye is darting around based on a fractal geometry, though, maybe that's not the best way. Maybe you don't want these things in a simple row. We're trying to work out the natural way that the eye wants to absorb the information. Is it going to be similar to a lot of these other subconscious processes? Body motion. When you're balancing, what are you actually doing there? It's something subconscious and it works, and you're stringing together big sways and small sways and smaller sways. Could those all be connected together to actually be doing a fractal pattern there? More and more physiological processes have been found to be fractal.
Not everyone in science is convinced of fractal geometry's potential for delivering new knowledge. Skeptics argue that it's done little to advance mathematical theory. But in Toronto, biophysicist Peter Burns and his colleagues see fractals as a practical tool, a way to develop mathematical models that might help in diagnosing cancer earlier.
Detecting very small tumors is one of the big challenges in medical imaging.
Burns knew that one early sign of cancer is particularly difficult to see, a network of tiny blood vessels that forms with the tumor. Conventional imaging techniques like ultrasound aren't powerful enough to show them.
We need to be able to see structures which are just a few tenths of a millionth of a meter across. When it comes to a living patient, we don't have the tools to be able to see these tiny blood vessels.
But ultrasound does provide a very good picture of the overall movement of blood. Is there any way, Burns wondered, that images of blood flow could reveal the hidden structure of the blood vessels? To find out, Burns and his colleagues used fractal geometry to make a mathematical model.
If you have a mathematical way of analyzing a structure, you can make a model. What fractals do is they give you some simple rules by which you can create models. And by changing some of the parameters of the model, we can change how the structure looks.
The model showed the flow of blood in the kidney, first through normal blood vessels, and then through vessels feeding a cancerous tumor. Burns discovered that the two kinds of networks had very different fractal dimensions.
Instead of being neatly bifurcating, looking like a nice elm tree, the tumor vasculature is chaotic and tangled and disorganized, looking more like a mistletoe bush.
And the flow of blood through these tangled vessels looked very different than in a normal network. A difference doctors might one day be able to detect with ultrasound.
We've always thought that we have to make medical images sharper and sharper, ever more precise, ever more microscopic in their resolution to find out the information about the structure that's there. What's exciting about this is it's giving us microscopic information without us actually having to look through a microscope.
You can see it rises up as the bubbles.
We think that this fractal approach may be helpful in distinguishing benign from malignant lesions in a way that hasn't been possible up to now.
It may take years before fractals can help doctors predict cancer, but they are already offering clues to one of biology's more tantalizing mysteries. Why big animals use energy more efficiently than little ones? That's a question that fascinates biologists James Brown and Brian Enquist, and physicist Jeffrey West.
There is an extraordinary economy of scale as you increase in size.
An elephant, for example, is 200,000 times heavier than a mouse, but uses only about 10,000 times more energy in the form of calories it consumes.
The bigger you are, you actually need less energy per gram of tissue to stay alive. That is an amazing fact.
And even more amazing is the fact that this relationship between the mass and energy use of any living thing is governed by a strict mathematical formula.
So far as we know, that law is universal, or almost universal, across all of life. So it operates from the tiniest bacteria to whales and sequoia trees.
But even though this law had been discovered back in the 1930s, no one had been able to explain it.
We had this idea that it probably had something to do with how resources are distributed within the bodies of organisms as they varied in size.
We took this big leap and said, all of life, in some way, is sustained by these underlying networks that are transporting oxygen, resources, metabolites that are feeding cells. Circulatory systems and respiratory systems and renal systems and neural systems. It was obvious that fractals were staring us in the face.
If all these biological networks are fractal, it means they obey some simple mathematical rules, which can lead to new insights into how they work.
If you think about it for a minute, it would be incredibly inefficient to have a set of blueprints for every single stage of increasing size. But if you have a fractal code, a code that says when to branch as you get bigger and bigger, then a very simple genetic code can produce what looks like a complicated organism.
Evolution by natural selection has hit upon a design that appears to give the most bang for the buck.
In 1997, West, Brown, and Enquist announced their controversial theory that fractals hold the key to the mysterious relationship between mass and energy use in animals.
Okay, I'm going to stop there. Now, obviously, we're not looking at a we're not looking at a program on the Bhagavad Gita. So there's no Sanskrit. There's no reference to divinities or eternal souls or anything like that. But there are parallels. And there are suggestions that some quite elegant formula for creation is at work on scales that are so small that we are not always able to perceive them. So those of you who just came in recently, prior to the screening of this clip, we were talking about how life can seem very chaotic. And maybe, just as in fractals, where something very complex really is drawing its inspiration from an elegant, simple formula that's operating on a scale so small we can't perceive it, perhaps the events and the circumstances of our life also spring from some place that is invisible to us, to our limited senses, but which also has that underlying purpose to it. It suggests that the mess of our life might actually have some structure. And that's a tough one to kind of absorb. We would like it otherwise. I think we would like to think that the bad stuff is happenstantial, circumstantial. It doesn't really have a purpose. Because the notion that there is some higher order of reality, some God behind creation that allows bad things to happen, particularly when bad things happen to good people, just rubs us the wrong way. Now, are any of you familiar with the book of that name by Rabbi Harold Kushner? Okay. Well, going back, I guess, to somewhere in the early 90s, perhaps, Rabbi Harold Kushner wrote a book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And it was an instant bestseller. And in the introduction to this book, Rabbi Kushner describes what brought him to write the book. He and his wife had the very tragic experience of watching their young child grow old and die before their eyes. A very rare genetic condition. I do not remember the name. Huh? Progeria, thank you. It's a rapid aging. So that a child, I think in their son's case of 12 or 13, literally died of old age. And by the time he was 12 or 13, he looked like a wizened old man. And it basically flew in the face of everything that Rabbi Kushner had ever studied as a rabbi. And he had to confront this very difficult dilemma of either accepting that God is not all good, or God is not all powerful. He can't possibly be both. If God is all good, but not all powerful, well, it means that there is evil in the world and God simply can't control it. If God is all powerful, that means that there is no higher evil in the world. It means that God sometimes might not be all good. And that formula he could not accept. So Kushner opted for the first explanation, which is that for him, there is evil in the world, there is chaos in the world, you have to leave room for it, and even though there is a God in control, things will happen outside God's purview.
It's absurd. I mean, it is.
Okay. Any other reactions? Look, all that I'm doing, I'm not, trying to clue you in onto the secrets of the universe. I'm putting some stuff out for your thought. These are mind games. Yeah?
The idea of good or bad is in the eye of the beholder. So I can think that something that's happening to me is a really bad thing. But that's my judgment about it. Exactly.
So what you're saying...
So I'm saying that God is bad or good. And is that really my role to make that decision?
So you're leaving room for some deeper sense to things that we may not perceive. It may seem bad to us, but perhaps there's some other dimension to it that we're just not seeing. We're not understanding it.
Because if nothing bad ever happens to you, then nothing happens to you.
Okay, that's one of the balloons that Kushner pops with his little pin in his book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. He says, we can come to this conclusion that maybe God's trying to teach us a lesson. Mm. Maybe this bad thing is happening to us because there's something that we're supposed to learn. Okay. Well, it kind of begs the question, what lesson does a 12-year-old child who's done no harm to anyone that we can understand possibly need to learn by dying from this terrible disease called progeria? My granddaughter, who's 6 and a half now, is born and through gross negligence ends up with cerebral palsy, autoneuropathy, has to be fed through a tube in her stomach. What lesson exactly is she supposed to learn from that? So that's one of the balloons that Kushner very effectively pops with his little editorial pin, right? And there are other balloons like that. And basically, all of these little explanations that we come up with are his way of indicating that maybe when disaster happens, God is not in the disaster. God is in the opportunity that circumstance provides for us to go out and offer compassion and love and care to others. So that's how he makes his peace with evil in the world, the chaos that our senses perceive.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking this seems like his perspective is really only one or the other. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really leave room for a discussion about all the different possibilities.
Like what are some of the other possibilities that there's no room for discussion in that perspective?
I haven't read the book, so I don't know if he touches on this, mm-hmm. but one thought that came into my mind was the perspective of karma. I don't know if he touches on that, but that's another perspective that can be considered.
Yeah.
There's probably a Vedic tradition that can be incorporated into this conversation. It doesn't sound
very
like
good.
A, so it seems like a very narrow mm-hmm. view of a situation that doesn't invite room for discussion about from other traditions.
All right, does everybody hear that suggestion, that idea? Now, it happens that Kushner does touch on karma in his book. But his point is, how do we know? If the karma is the consequence of something that happened in previous lives, we'll never know it. There's no record of that ever happening. So he's kind of down on karma just because there's no way of tracking it. You know, it seems like a kind of band-aid, philosophical band-aid to put over bad things happening to people. But yes, that's a very perceptive alternate view of how things happen, and it happens to be the Vedic perspective as well, that we may not perceive what happened previously. That does not negate the prospect that it's there. So that's one element. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I was going to basically make that comment that because we may not understand it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. There's many things we just like. They're understanding so many things about fractals that previously weren't understood before. But mm-hmm. that through careful examination, they're saying, yes, there is this underlying beatific pattern in mm-hmm. perhaps everything.
Yeah.
So in the same way, there's things happen that appear this way or that way, oftentimes negative, but there's, if you go back, I mean, just I had the experience of having a Nadi reading in India, where there's a book called The Hidden Oracle of India. And there's different things, Brigha readings, Nadi readings, where without going into detail, they find palm leaves that were written thousands of years ago about your life, according to different types of your thumbprints and different patterns. And in my particular case, they were able to determine in the Tamil language of my mother's name, and first name of my mother and father, and so many amazing details of my life, talked about my previous karmas, and it was mind-blowing. Now, I could understand how certain things are happening in the context of my current life by things that I did that were impacted others negatively in my previous life. So sometimes that knowledge becomes available. There's no way of verifying that, obviously. But certainly from the Vedic paradigm, we see that there's reactions to what's happened previously. And it's simply the laws of the universe. And that eventually if a soul becomes more aware, that soul will be understand what those lessons are.
Okay, now, Bhattarayan, you and I go way back, okay? We're buds. Okay. So you know that like you, I ascribe to the Gita vision of previous lives, reincarnation, past karma, etc. I buy into that. What do you say to victims of extreme abuse, people get what they deserve? What do you say to children killed in intra-tribal warfare? People get what they deserve.
I mean,
is that a good idea?
You know, it's as we've understood from our background in this study of this tradition, that the laws of karma and how they enact, how they play out in the world is very subtle. It's very subtle. So, on one hand, yes, that everyone is, it's understood that not a blade of grass moves without the sanctioned by the supreme authority and the supreme art. So everything is ultimately being sanctioned by God, because nothing is moving without his awareness or his hand, so to speak. So there is some, yes, there is some lesson being meted out from the past, and there's always an equal or opposite, equal or greater gain to be found within that challenge.
Okay, you understand I play devil's advocate up here.
Yes.
All right, in a report filed in the 2 years following the liberation of the concentration camps called the Buchenwald Report, there's a description of some of the behavior of the people who ran the camps. And there's one story in particular that describes how an SS officer came up to a woman who was holding her six-month-old child and said, "You have to surrender your child." The woman refused. And this officer grabbed the child and ripped the baby in half in front of her mother. Okay, I use that example in classes as a way of kind of driving home the notion that positing the idea of karma suggests that millions of people in previous lives all performed such egregious actions that they've all come to a place where they are receiving this kind of utterly, unimaginably brutal, terrifying treatment as a consequence of their own deeds.
You know, it's like I was in Auschwitz. I was in Auschwitz many years ago.
You mean you visited Auschwitz?
I visited Auschwitz. I may have been there previously, I don't know, but I visited Auschwitz, and it was exceptionally sobering. Mm-hmm. And I thought of a slaughterhouse. Now, I'm not saying that A plus B equals C in this regard, but I'm saying that the principle. A slaughterhouse look what happens to the cows. What happens to the chickens.
Okay. We go way back.
Right.
Okay. So, you know I'm with you on this.
So, to say that if something terrible happens to me, hey, I'm a good person. I would have to say, there is something that was performed previously. If we understand karma, if we understand Daivanaitrena, that there's a divine will in everything, then I have to accept the harsh reality, it would seem, that there is some previous responsibility that's resulting in current so-called tragedy. But within that, there is a potential, because life continues beyond the tragedy or beyond the horrific death, that there is, just like Prabhupada said, so many people are outraged against capital punishment. Prabhupada said, no, capital punishment must be there, because if somebody commits a murder,
okay,
and they're not...
We're getting about 10 things rolled into one here. I would suggest that theologically, scripturally, what you're saying holds up quite well. Socially, I wouldn't get into it in a cocktail party.
Right, of course.
Because it's probably the quickest way I can think of to alienate pretty much everybody I've ever met. And there is some responsibility, I think, to wield this information very, very, very carefully.
I see that that's what you're
very
careful.
Yeah, we're looking at how do we do this? How do we take this worldview, which is sophisticated, complete, compelling, and move it through the lens of the life we know? Now, just to balance that picture, because what you provided is an accurate perspective on one element within the Vedic theology, another element would be that there's also the influence of irresponsible government on the citizenry, which needs to be addressed. In other words, while we may have a belief in this notion of karma, it does not negate the fact that there is a difference between good governance and bad governance, and that there's a responsibility to address wrongdoing when it is occurring. All right, so there's both things are going there simultaneously. Yes, Lauren.
One thought I had was that can kind of, if you're putting aside managing the wrongdoing from a cause perspective and you're just looking to comfort or emotionally support people who have been victims of some sort of, like you said, horrific abuse, just invoking what you said about Prabhupada earlier, does it matter? Can you just say, help that person recall whatever their faith or belief pattern is that gives them support and use that to help them versus trying to encourage them with your worldview or the perceived worldview? Because if it's really just about getting that person or group of people to a place where they feel supported by some greater power, does it matter what approach you take to get there?
Yeah. You're putting your finger on a very, very important recent development within the Krishna culture. In its early stages, Prabhupada, when he was here, drew a rather hard line when it came to, let's call it, the interfaith dialogue. And he was representing the Krishna tradition, the bhakti tradition, and did so uncompromisingly. I don't think that... I knew him to some extent. I traveled with him and I had a lot of time with him. I don't think at any point I ever saw him insensitive to other expressions of faith. And I think you're quite right. Sometimes the best thing that you can do is to approach someone from their perspective, their worldview, rather than imposing your own on them. How about just listening? It's a great gift. Someone's in trouble. Don't tell them what the answer is to their problem. How about just listening? You know, that's an awfully big gift. Recently, there's been a real evolution in this area of understanding that the test of your own conviction, your own faith, is that you will be capable of stepping outside that conviction far enough to listen with wide open ears to what other people have to say, and accepting that we may have this vision of Krishna in the spiritual world dancing with the gopis, and we, you know, this beautiful image of that eternal realm. Other people also have their covenant with God, and it is not less valid. That's taken some time to come to that place. But I do not know of a faith community anywhere that isn't having to confront it. The world is too interconnected now. We're not separate communities. We're really so intertwined in each other's lives that we're having to revisit what is our role in the world moving forward. As a person of faith, what is my role with regard to other people of faith? Different faiths. Or no faith at all. Are they excluded from some divine plan because they don't share my ideas? Shakti.
Well, I was going to make a point that you actually just made, which is two points, but one was very short, which is when someone's in a time of crisis, it's not the time to tell them about the mysteries of the world.
Yeah, really.
But I was also going to say, I feel or have experienced that a more beautiful picture is helping someone understand, not necessarily when they're in a moment of crisis, but whenever you're just speaking to someone in general about the philosophy, it's like the philosophy of Vedic culture. It's that if these bodies, which all of us across faiths believe are temporary, and no, I should say believe, we know that these bodies are temporary, and that all faiths across every single tradition understands that the soul is eternal, then really understanding what does that mean on a realization platform. Because then if you really understand that on a realization platform, then whatever's happening to you in this temporary 90 years has to have a huge spectrum of perspective. Mm-hmm. That obviously, unless you have that and you cultivate that when you're not in a traumatic situation and when you're not either staring at a horrible situation in the face or a death right. in the face, then, you know, so ultimately my understanding is that we all understand that we're eternal, but how much do we dig mm-hmm. into? What does that really mean?
Oh, bless you for saying that. That's my bugaboo. Is that you know, us old fogies, you know, we grew up in that first generation of Krishna practice when you spent the day studying. I mean, you read books, you went deep into the philosophy, really deep, and you memorized verses and you read commentaries. You know, real old school, the old Math system of India, where, you know, that's what you did. You became qualified. You equipped yourself with knowledge, depth of knowledge. And it was extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. Prabhupada's, the carrot that he dangled was, if you do this, if you do your daily chanting, and if you study these texts, one day you will see God. Face to face. Not only will you see God, God will dance with you. Now, you know, no one had ever heard anything anywhere like this, anywhere. You know, so bold, so declarative that this is, you know, ripping the cover away. If mathematics and fractals are the language by which we can understand how nature works, here was a formula being presented for peeling away the last layer and seeing where nature came from. Absolutely stunning. And in those days, those of us who were privileged to know Prabhupada became really quite committed to wanting to go to that place that he was describing. So... okay, any other comments? What did you think of that clip? Did it ring true? Unfortunately, it didn't include some of the very, very beautiful computer renderings of what fractals look like. Imagine, for example, a fern leaf. If you take a fern leaf and then take a little piece of one of the branches of that fern leaf and look at it under a microscope or a magnifying glass, it looks just like the big fern leaf you just took it from. And if you take one of the little branches off of that little clipping that you've taken and look at it up again, it'll look just like the whole fern leaf. And that same principle of nature having a formula that repeats itself is there in the veins of the body, in the coastlines of countries. So it's a beautiful tool for seeing something that otherwise we may not see. That there are these elegant formulas at work in creation. And maybe what we can take away from this discussion, I hope, is the possibility, allowing room in our lives for the possibility that those same kinds of very elegant foundational formulas are at work even in the most chaotic moments that we confront. And if we take the time to breathe, take a big, deep cleansing breath, and as long as you're breathing, you might as well chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama. Maybe we'll qualify ourselves for perceiving some of that elegance just beneath the surface of perceptions. Good. Thank you. All right. Very good comments, very good questions. As always, you're all coming along very well. And I'm sorry I didn't get to see you last week, Thanksgiving. Sometimes life interferes with having fun. And I have no idea what next week's discussion is going to be about. I haven't thought about it. But if you... Fractals Part 2. If you're not already subscribed to the newsletter, or if you'd like to find out what it is, or just surprise yourself, just come next week and we'll have something fun. Any other comments or questions before we adjourn? Yes?
Hi. First of all, I read a comment from a Brazilian bishop. I forgot what I read, it doesn't matter. He said, I would like, in regard to what you said about bad things happen to good people, I would like to ask God why good things happen to bad things happen to good people, war, injustice, rape, starvation. he says, but I don't, because I'm afraid that he's going to ask the same question to me. Isn't it amazing? So aren't we all guilty at a certain degree of always happening around us? You know, not to protest enough, not to care enough, not to...
I'm trying to remember who it was who said about the Jews that the non-Jews who did nothing to help the Jews, that they may not all have been guilty, but they were all responsible. That's the kind of engaged Vaishnavism that I believe Prabhupada came to propagate. That your spiritual life is intimately connected to your participation in the world around you. That can no longer be avoided. The time for just standing aside and doing nothing is long past. We're here to become, if you will, agents of spiritual change in the world. So that's a very, very nice way of being reminded of that. Thank you.
Yeah. I was very between going to the protest on Union Square about what was happening there today and coming here because, you know, I had a little problem in my leg, so I can't be in two places. So I said, I'm not guilty for not being there. I'm going here.
Well, thank you for coming to the discussion. Sure. Any last questions or comments?
Say that your coming here was also a protest.
Well said. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you.